Okay. So what I wanted to show was that trying to show that really in the Torah there are amazing things, but the amazing things in the Torah and the agadic statements of the rabbis are things that are real, not things that are of the nature of fantasy. And so if you take an agadic statement and you just interpret it literally, it sounds like the fantastic. But if you interpret it intelligently, then you can see that it has it conveys deep meaning. Now, the as I said, the concept behind that story about creating a human being is that even though you do have, there will be a time, and this is something that was known, that there will be a time that you will have genetic engineering, but it would not be appropriate to. It would not be appropriate to utilize that for any purpose, because there's no purpose in simply creating a physical human being that does not have a soul. Now, there's this same story, and I want to support what I'm saying from the fact that the story is brought in two places. Or a similar story, I should say. One place was where I mentioned last week. Just give me a moment over here. I gotta find it again. Yes, that was Sanhedrin. Just a second. Yes, it was, Sanhedrin, it was 65B, I believe it was. I mentioned that last week. Yeah, 65B in Sanhedrin. Now, the story, similar, they're kind of parallel stories. This story mentions about Rava that created a human being, and then it also mentions a story, yeah. Okay, there's another story that's brought in two places. And that's the next story, and I'm going to just mention that one. The next story is about Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Oshia. And it says every Erev Shabbos, that means every Friday, they would get together, and they would involve themselves in the book of creation. Okay, and they would create a young calf or a fat calf, and they would eat it. Okay, that's the story. Now, the same story is brought two pages later. And it says that over there, there's only one difference. The difference is over there, it doesn't say the book of creation. It says the halachos of creation, hilchos yitzira. Now, halacha is an ethical regulation, as you know. Every time you have the word halacha, it means an ethical regulation, which falls in line with the interpretation I gave before. Namely, that this is not a book of creation. In other words, a book of magic, where you can simply decipher how to create some kind of a golem or a creature. But what it is it has to do with ethical regulations concerning creation. In other words, it tells us about the whether man can create, okay? It can be called a book because it's a subject, but it's also called Hilchos Yetzirah, which means the laws and regulations of creation, because that's the main purpose of the book, to teach a person the ethical principles involved in human creativity. And since the Torah is based on the fundamental principle that everything in the universe is rational and works with God's wisdom, that's found throughout the prophets. So therefore, it is feasible, it is possible, and it would seem that that was part of the Mesorah, that it was handed down that from Sinai, that man can really gain access to these areas of life, namely to control biologically and to create biologically certain organisms, and in the future. However, there had to be regulations, ethical regulations, regarding that as well, even though that wasn't possible in those days. Now, as I said, the true Kabbalists say, with regard to the second story as well, that it doesn't really mean that it happened, it actually occurred. If you just take it literally, it says, they created a fattened calf and they ate it. Okay? Now, first of all, if the rabbis were able to do that, then Hillel would not be a poor person. As you know, Hillel was one of the greatest scholars, and he was a very poor person. He had to chop wood for a living. So he wouldn't have to do that if he can create calves. I mean, it would be very simple for him to become very wealthy in a short amount of time by creating these calves. What it means is as follows. What the story over here means, the concept and the halacha, which means the ethical regulation concerning creation, is as follows. That with regard to calves, and that's why it's differentiating between the case of the calves, it brings down both stories. It's differentiating between the case of the calves and the case of a human being. In the case of a human being, you know, the regulation is that man should not do that. Even if man reaches a level of knowledge where he can create a human being, he should refrain from doing that because it would be a soulless human being. However, with regard to the calves, you see, there is different. It says that they would do it every Erev Shabbos. That means the day before Shabbos, Friday. Now, what is the importance of the day before the Sabbath? Okay. Now, the Sabbath day, we have through the Masorah, the Sabbath day really represents, it's not just a day of rest. The Sabbath day is supposed to be the perfect day of human existence. That's supposed to be the one day where a human being truly exists as a human being, where he ceases to be involved in his technological knowledge. It's a day of technological rest. That's why you have the 39 creative prohibitions, creative work. Man is not involved anymore in his physical creativity. He relates to God, and he's involved in intellectual creativity. It's really a day of intellect and study, and relating to God through knowledge. And it's supposed to be an enjoyable day physically as well, because the Torah's philosophy is that a person, a human being, can have a harmonious existence where he enjoys the physical and he enjoys wisdom and knowledge. The two are not mutually exclusive. On the contrary, the two merge and give a person the epitome of human life. So what the rabbis are saying here is that to create a fattened calf, in other words, if a person would have access, and that's why it says the laws of creation, if a person would have access, would be able, have the ability to create a calf, would that be an appropriate thing for a human being to do? So the rabbis were discussing that. So what it says is that it can be done on the day before the Sabbath, meaning to say it would only be proper to do that if it was eaten for the purpose of Sabbath, which means only if it were done for the pure reason of sustaining man and giving man a level of human existence, which is truly human existence par excellence, the perfect level of human existence. If that is the purpose, if it's utilized for that purpose, then it would be permissible. And that's why you have these two stories. So these two stories that have to do with the ethical regulations concerning human creation, which wasn't possible at the time, nevertheless, the scholars did discuss what would be if it were possible, or a man in the future would be able to gain control over the laws of nature to the degree where they could actually create beings. So, with regard to the human being, it would be wrong to do that. With regard to the animal world, if man can utilize his biotechnology in a way that he can produce animals that would be used for the purpose of purpose of promoting the perfect life, a life of perfection, that would be fine, but for no other reason. That's basically the stories of the that's basically what these two stories mean. So really, when you look at them from a realistic standpoint, they're wonderful stories, and they really they teach us and teach us ideas and concepts and guide us more now than ever before in our approach, because this is we've reached a point where we're in a dangerous situation with biological engineering, as you very well know. There are many ethical problems that arise from that sphere of human activity. And the Talmud is telling us that this was already dealt with by the scholars, and there was a special book that was dedicated to that. Now there is a book called Sefer Yetzirah, which we have, and Sadia Gaon, as a matter of fact, wrote an interpretation of it, and it's he explains the whole book in a rational manner. Whether that is the book that the Talmud is speaking about or not is questionable. We don't know. As I said, here it calls it by two names. It calls it the Book of Yetzirah. It also calls it the Laws of Yetzirah, which is halachic, the halachos of Yetzirah. Okay, there's another story over here that I think is also one that's interesting, that I think that it is worthwhile interpreting. The Talmud tells us that, this one is on 60, I hope I didn't say 75B last week, I think I may have said 75B, it's 65. Now this one is on 67B, okay? The Talmud states as follows, that, Talmud says, okay, that this is, again, okay, 67b. Talmud says, Ein od movado, which is a verse in Deuteronomy 4. It means, there is none other besides him, meaning besides God. So now the Talmud says, Rabbi Hanina said that this means that even the even belief in magic and sorcery, which means to say, Rabbi Hanin is interpreting the verse that when a person says there's nothing else besides God, they mean there are no other powers, nothing. If a person believes that there are other powers, this is a denial of God's oneness. Okay. Now it says as follows. It says there was this woman that she tried to sort of spook Rabbi Hanina. So she would take dirt from under his feet and she would, I don't know what she exactly what she did, but she would do some kind of magic or sorcery with the dust from under his feet. I guess that was some kind of way she thought of harming him. So he said to her that, he says, if you want to do this, go ahead and do it. It doesn't bother me. He says, because the Torah says there is none other besides him. Okay? So now the Talmud says, but Rabbi Yochanan said that why do you call the name in Hebrew Kisha Mechashvim, okay, which means sorcerers, so it says, because they can undo, I'm not going to go into the Hebrew, but it's just, because, forget, you know, I'm not going to go into the linguistics, but the Talmud says, because they can counteract the heavenly hosts, which means to say God's decree. Okay, so they're saying over here that the magic can undo God's decree. So how could Rabbi Hanina say he's not worried about what she does? Okay. So the Talmud says, no, Rabbi Hanina is different. Why? Because he is on a very high level. Okay. He's a very high level individual. Now, there are many people that interpret this statement of the Talmud as meaning that there is something to magic and sorcery. All right. I like to quote Ibn Ezra in Leviticus, what Ibn Ezra says. He quotes people that maintain that there's something to this, and he says, He says they believe that there is some truth in magic and sorcery. He says, and that the Torah prohibited this. He says, but I say the Torah prohibited that which is false and not that which is true. And as well as Maimonides, of course, says the same thing. Now, I'd like to just explain what the Talmud means over here. Now, really, if you look at the Talmud, you'll notice the Talmud is explaining a verse in the Torah. Now, that's very serious. So when Rabbi Hanina says that the verse in the Torah which says there is none other besides him, and that means not even sorcery or magic, what is he saying? He's saying that that is the intent of the verse, which means this verse is telling us that if a person believes in magic and sorcery, then that's a denial of God on a certain level. They just believe in that, it's a denial of God, because they do believe in other forces, all right? And the true monotheism of the Torah means there's no other forces besides God, okay? Now, what the Talmud means, so then the question is, so why does the Talmud say that magic can undo the decree, the heavenly decrees? The reason, and then it says, no, and it says, well, Rabbi Hanina is different because he's on a very high level. What that means, actually, is that, you see, the rabbis knew that most people are not capable of really being on the highest level. As a matter of fact, in the Tractate of Psachim, the rabbis mention that there are certain things that are superstitions and that the rabbis knew people had, but they simply could not go against them. Because you have to understand that you cannot just overnight create a perfected person. The Torah doesn't expect that either. That's why the Torah has laws concerning idolatry, and there's a certain form to the laws, but there are many things that have idolatrous ways of thought that the halacha does not forbid, does not prescribe. And the reason is, because if you're just going to say that every person that has a superstition, that has any kind of superstition, is considered an idolater, then, you know, then there's no more people left, because most people are not on a level where, you know, where they just don't believe in any superstition. That's a very high level human being. So what the Talmud, that's exactly what the Talmud is saying, that the magic and sorcery can undo the heavenly decree. What it means is that even if a person, according to God, should have a good life, a person who believes in certain superstitions will have a bad life. And we know it's a known fact that, like, people in Africa who believe in voodoo, someone can simply pronounce a spell and then they'll die instantaneously. How does that work? Because the person believes it so much that his brain affects his nervous system, which is related to his heart, and his heart can cease pumping. So the psyche can affect the person's body. For instance, we have a law against I'm calling it halacha right now tentatively. I'll explain it to you. Against marrying a woman who lost several husbands. Now, Maimonides was asked the question, well, what happens, you know, what do you do if somebody does marry a woman that has several husbands, had died in the past? So Maimonides states that, he says, this is not a halacha. He says, this is simply what the Talmud is saying, is that most people are not going to be able to overcome their fears. So that's why they recommend against it. But if a person doesn't believe in that, they're free of the superstition. There certainly is no prohibition. That's the way Maimonides is. Maimonides proves it by the fact that the Talmud says the court does not enforce it. So he says, so you see, it's a practical thing. Now the rabbis realize that, and the Torah realizes, that a person cannot be totally free, an average person cannot be totally free of superstition, so that's why the Torah does not say that anyone that is superstitious in any shape, form, or manner is an idolater. That would exclude everybody from Torah. But what it does is it defines idolatry in a halachic way, the serious idolatry, and that is deserving of serious penalty, but the lesser forms, even though they stem from the same source, are tolerated by Torah. Now, That's what the Talmud is saying over here. Talmud is saying that even though the magic and superstition can contradict the heavenly decree, which means a person can harm themselves because they believe in these things, nevertheless, this doesn't apply to Rabbi Hanina, because he was a great person, and he was free from all of this, and therefore it couldn't affect him. And that's why Rabbi Hanina stated that when it says, he gave a beautiful interpretation of the verse, there is nothing, none other besides him, that means to say that there is none other besides God, and he was free from all kind of mystical and superstitious beliefs and notions. And him it didn't affect. But the average person, if someone, you can imagine it especially in those days, but even today, under certain conditions, if someone would really be in a certain state of mind and in the presence of certain people in a certain environment, and someone would cast a spell on them, it might affect them psychologically. It might affect them psychologically. So that's why the Talmud says that it can overrule the heavenly decree. But not for a great scholar like Rabbi Hanina, who is purified from all this type of nonsensical beliefs through Torah. So him, it has no effect on. That's why he said, do whatever you want. There's none other besides God. That's the rational interpretation of the Talmudic statement. And it makes a beautiful sense. You know, in this past week's reading, you'll notice the way the Torah expresses itself. And the Torah says that you must keep all my commandments. And immediately after that, it mentions idolatry. Okay, because the idolatry is really, as we mentioned many times, that this is in Deuteronomy 12. Okay, it says in Deuteronomy 11, 32, it says you should keep all the commandments which I give you today. And then the next verse, it says these are the commandments. And the verse after that is to destroy all the idolatry and not to follow it. And as Ramban says, Nachmanides states, that it means to say that you're not even permitted to, that you might say the reason what's wrong with idolatry is that they're serving the wrong God. But how about if I take some of their practices and serve our God with their practices? So Ramban says no, that's what the, specifically what the Torah says, that you should not learn to do what they do. In other words, anything that they do, anything whatsoever that they do, is prohibited because it stems from the pagan source. And that's why I said it's important to understand the mindset of the primitive, because everything that's involved in that really is idolatrous. And that's why it says, where was Moses buried? It says Moses was buried opposite the Beis Peor. That's the that was a very famous idol. And why is Moses buried opposite Beis Peor, the idol? The reason is because Moses was the exact opposite of idolatry. He was the man that was completely free from any kind of idolatrous trends. That's the highest level of man. I'd like to also explain. That's why the Talmud states that if the people that the righteous would be able to create worlds, and they interpret the verse in Isaiah where it says that God says that your sins differentiate between you and I. So the rabbis say that means that that just like God creates, man would be able to create, but his sins are removing him from doing that. So what it means, of course, is that if man would create for the proper reason, which is for Shabbos, then it would be permissible. But since man isn't righteous, and if he would misuse these powers, that's why these powers weren't given to him and weren't revealed to him. What will happen in the future, it remains to be seen. I mean, it could very well be, and we hope that the Messianic era will arrive before man advances too far with his uncovering some of the secrets of nature. He might be better off not being able to do certain things at this time. I would like to continue with a couple of more points, and that is that this is important to know. Again, you know, there's the false Kabbalah, which is the Kabbalah that goes around today, and basically it's very easy to tell the false from the true, and that is that the false is always prevalent among the ignoramuses, people that are not scholars of the Torah. I want to repeat this again, the fact that Nachmanides is always considered the head of the Kabbalists, because he was truly a Torah scholar, world-renowned Torah scholar, and he also knew Kabbalah, which he received from his teachers. Now, Nachmanides, what I want to emphasize, Nachmanides was not a mystical mind. Nachmanides was a very rational mind, and if you study carefully his interpretation of Torah, you'll see that's true. I would like to point to one instance. There are many, but just the one instance that would clearly show you that Nachmanides was a true rationalist, and that is when it comes to the story of the rainbow. So if you look at the verses in the Torah, so it says that. It says that it's 9:13. So in Genesis 9:13, that God says that my bow I placed in a cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenantal sign between me and the earth. Okay. Now, so Nachmanides at first says, well, it would seem on the surface that the rainbow was created then at that time. But Nachmanides says, but those who know Greek science, the Greeks have already shown that the rainbow is nothing more than a natural phenomenon. Then Nachmanides returns to the verse, and he says, if you look more carefully at the verse, it doesn't say, I am creating the rainbow the rainbow right now as a sign, but it says it in the past tense in Hebrew. I have put the rainbow in the cloud. Which means to say the rainbow is really a natural phenomenon, and God simply designated it as a sign, but it wasn't created at that time. And Nachmanides says we cannot deny Greek science. The Greeks have shown us through scientific observation, because the Greeks studied light, and they showed that the rainbow is nothing more than a regular physical phenomenon. And he says we cannot deny that, because that's a scientific fact. And throughout if one looks at the true Torah scholars, like the Tosafists and Nachmanides, and of course Maimonides, I don't have to say, because everybody knows that Maimonides was a pure rationalist. But the other scholars, they always give credence and give the greatest respect to scientific knowledge. I mean, there's a Tosafist in Erevan where the Talmud says pi is a ratio of pi is 3, and the Tosafist says, but the mathematicians have shown that it's not 3, it's more than 3. So he remains with the question, doesn't answer it. Maimonides answers the question, because Maimonides shows that the halacha can't deal with infinity, so it has to be rounded off to 3. But Tosafists simply remain with the question.
It's time to turn the table.
Okay. Okay. Now the story of the goat. There are many stories, and I want to speak especially about a certain individual, an Abraham Abulafia, who is always the Kabbalists, always the modern, the false Kabbalists, I should call them, modern day Kabbalists, invoke the name of Abraham Abulafia. I will get to that in a moment. But the question of the Golem of Prague is really baseless. The story is baseless. It's an old German folktale that goes back, I believe, to the 11th century. How it became related with the Maharam of Prague, who was, again, a brilliant mind, if you study his works, brilliant, rational individual, and how it became associated with him, I do not know, but I could just tell you that it is baseless. I don't know how these I mean, it's hard to trace a lot of these stories, how they, you know, how they get started and they become associated with certain individuals, but there is no authentic, it is absolutely a non-authentic story. I was mentioning before. There's, again, the Tosfos and Ervin say, in one of their questions, say, well, we see with our own eyes that this is the way it is, you know, that's one of the questions they raise on one of the Talmudic points in the, you know, in Ervin. The point I'm making is that in Torah, there never was an authentic scholar in Torah that believed in any other mode of understanding than the human intellect, knowledge. I mean, knowledge is the only thing that we have. And therefore, science was never questioned. We never had a Galileo syndrome, like the church had with Galileo, where they caused a person to recant because he makes a scientific discovery, which is against their imagination. There's no such thing in any of the Torah scholars. And I'm using Nachmanides, who's the head of the Kabbalists, to make that point clear, where he says, he many times makes recourse to science. And as I said last week, though, a lot of the science of the times was incorrect, and he was not a researcher in science, he was a researcher in Torah, and he accepted a lot of the science of the times, which, you know, you have no choice, really. I mean, a few centuries from now, things that we believe are true will be antiquated. That's the way science grows. God did not give us science at Sinai. He gave us a science of life, he gave us a science of halacha, but not physics, and therefore that's something which every person is always limited to their generation. Even Maimonides is limited to his generation. But it's very interesting, though. Maimonides, I'm just mentioning this as an aside, Maimonides happens to be singularly free from a lot of the scientific errors of his generation. I mentioned Nachmanides in one of his writings did believe certain stories that came back from India about certain types of trees and things. Maimonides, somehow or other, was a very keen intellect, and his intuition was great, very great. And, of course, Nachmanides himself does not consider him to be as great a scholar as Maimonides. And Maimonides, somehow or other, remained free from a lot of these things. He simply, you know, just, his mind just wouldn't accept it. So he had a great intuition, and he was really ahead of his time. He mentions some of these stories, and he says they're obviously false. And he just had a good scientific intuition. Certain things he just knew were false, even though people at that time believed in it. But because of his, you know, his great intuition, he rejected it. He was singularly free from any kind of mystical things at all. Whereas again, Nachmanides, while he was personally, personally free from them. His mode of thinking was always rationality and wisdom and knowledge, but certain things he did accept, and he thought, you know, it was accepted as a science of time, he did accept them. So that's something I think that should be understood. The one that I'd like to discuss is what I'd like to discuss is Abraham Abulafia. Now, his name comes up an awful lot of times, okay? And he is usually quoted by the Kabbalists. The false Kabbalists always, you know, try to use him as a some kind of a proof for their, you know, for their ideas. Now, Abraham Abulafia lived in the 13th century, okay? Now, he lived at the same time, at the one that we have writings, he lived in the 13th century. Now, the one that we have that went out against him, that was in his time, a contemporary of his, was Rashbah. Okay. Now, who is Rashbah? Rashbah was the greatest student of Nachmanides. Okay. And Rashbah, when interesting story happened with Abraham Abulafia. Abraham Abulafia, when he started to get involved, he was a bright guy, of course. He had a good mind, he was a bright guy. But then he started to, get off the course and, went away from halacha. As a matter of fact, he used to say that anyone that only studies halacha is a monkey. Okay? And that's one of the signs, by the way, of the false Kabbalists. They really dislike halacha, because halacha is complete reason. And there's no one that ever wrote a response on halacha that was based on anything but reason. If anybody did, it just throw them out. There's no such thing. So these people dislike halacha, and they're really never into it, because it's very, you know, it's very challenging intellectually. Now, Abraham Abulafia started off in halacha, but then he started to, when he was young, very young, then he started to get involved in this, in the Kabbalah. Okay? Now, he reached a point in Kabbalah where he thought he was a prophet, and that's what happens, you know, I mean, they start thinking that they're prophets, and then, of course, he was convinced he was Messiah. Alright? So, now, Messiahs were always very bad for Jews, who were being persecuted anyways, and whenever there was a Messiah, that meant trouble. Because Messiah meant, there's going to be an uprising. People will start to follow him, and he's going to rebel against, the Jews are going to rebel against the government. They're going to go wild, try to take over. So Messiah was always problems for Jews. Now, once he thought he was Messiah, Abulafia, he of course, was having problems, and they started to persecute him. And he was, you know, running from place to place. Then he decided... He made a decision, it's an interesting story, he made a decision to go to Nicholas, the Pope Nicholas III. And he wanted to really convince Pope Nicholas, who wasn't anti-Semite by the way, convince Pope Nicholas that he is the Messiah and the Redeemer of Israel. So, strange story happened. The Pope heard that he was coming, and it was sort of like a self-invitation. And the Pope gave orders that Abulafia should be captured, and they simply should grab him, take him, and he should be burnt at the stake. Okay, so Abulafia walks into right into this to meet the Pope, and what happened was that suddenly the Pope died. Strange event. He dies suddenly, boom, he's gone. So what happened was that the follower, those who were instructed by the Pope to arrest Abulafia and burn him, they got frightened. They thought maybe it was really because Abulafia was indeed a messianic figure and did have powers. So they didn't kill him. But he was incarcerated for a short while, and then he was released. But what happened was that Rashba heard about him. You know, he was creating a tunnel over there, and Rashba heard about him. And I'm just giving you a small quote from what Rashba said about him. He said one of them, meaning the false prophets, he says, was this lowlife, may the name of the wicked rot. He says that Abraham, that made himself into a prophet, and into a Messiah in Sicilia, and he seduced people with his lies. He seduced many of the Jews with his lies, and he says if it weren't for the fact that I closed the door before him with God's mercy, he says, and most of the things that he wrote, he was very impressive, and most of his imaginations and lies that people consider to be great wisdom, for the fool considers to be great wisdom, he says that he would have caused great harm. And he says, of course, his method was that he would take verses in the Torah, and he would take statements of the rabbis, and he'd use gematrios. By the way, gematrios is always a sign of there are some legitimate gematrios, but when they get into gematrios, this is a sign of the false Kabbalists. And he says, and of course, as I said, Rashba himself was a Kabbalist, because he was a student of the great Nachmanides. Of course, he was one of the greatest Talmudists, one of the greatest scholars as well. So he says that what he does is he takes these verses and he uses gematrias and he mixes in, he intermingles with them certain truths, certain true things as well that are taken from the you know, words of the words of wisdom. And and basically he said what he said was that you know, that basically the guy was a phony, and he says that he was happy that he was able to put an end to his career, which he did actually, because after you know, Rajba was world accepted, and once Rajba came out against him, he lost a lot of his following, and then he went from place to place. No one knows what happened to him in the end. He was in some obscure place and just vanished, basically. Now, just to show you again what Rajba says, he's, because the issue came up about the reason for sending away the bird with the, you know, with a nest, when a bird is nesting. Now, by the way, there is a Kabbalistic view that this is, someone called me recently about this, is a Kabbalistic notion that this is something that a person should do, because it says in the Torah that your days will be lengthened if you do this. So the Kabbalists actually believe that it is a mitzvah, it is a commandment that a person should try to fulfill this commandment, namely to try somehow or other to get a, you know, to be in a situation where there's a mother bird nesting on the eggs or on the babies, and then send away the mother and take the offspring. Now this is really absurd. Because the Torah, it is not, see, there are two types of commandments in the Torah. Some of them are written in a positive form, but really they're negatives. And this is one of them. Namely, you don't have to, you're not, there's no obligation, there's no fulfillment in taking in sending away the mother and taking the birds, taking the eggs. That's nonsense. It's a prohibition. You're not allowed to take both. But if you don't want to take any of them, you don't have to go climb up a tree that's 50 foot high and send away the mother. But the Kabbalists were attracted to this commandment, and they thought that really you're supposed to do it. As a matter of fact, they said at least once in your life you should fulfill this wonderful commandment. Of course, Maimonides' view becomes very clear if you study the guide, where he says the whole reason, one of the main reasons for that commandment was that most people are not going to bother already once they can't take the mother. And then they're not going to really bother because the eggs and the babies are not really that valuable as food. So really what the Torah is trying to do is to dissuade people from doing that. But this was a Kabbalistic thing, and Rajba says that he says there is a very deep meaning behind this. He says, but I can't explain it because most people are not able to understand the depth and the abstract refinement of the intellect that's necessary in order to understand this reason. He says there's only a few people that are on that level. So Rajba was a true Kabbalist, but his Kabbalah was obviously of an intellectual sort, where it was ideas. And he says most people cannot understand it because their minds are not as very, very developed. And that's why most people can't understand Talmud, because Talmud also requires a very rigid training and a refined intellect, and not everybody can understand certain areas of the Talmud. Of course, you know, everybody can understand, but as you get into some of the deeper issues of the Talmud, it becomes very difficult. Even great scholars do not understand certain areas in the Talmud because it's too abstract for them. And Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned his grandfather, certain areas of Talmud, he simply said, I don't know, I don't study that area, I just can't understand it. So the Talmud is very abstract, and not everybody can understand it. But Rajba was talking about the Kabbalah, and he says the same thing, that people cannot understand it. He said, I can't really explain the reason, because it requires a very fine mind and abstract thought. Now, that really is basically puts an end to the Abulafia tale, almost, because what happened was that this, now we're talking about the time of Abulafia and the time which is the period of the Rishonim, which is the period in our history that we had a sequence of really great scholars, great minds, fantastic minds, like Ramban, you know, Nachmanides and Maimonides and Rashi, and it's an era of really, truly, truly great scholars. After that era, approximately like the 14th century, We never really had, except for one case, the Gaon of Vilna. But except for him and maybe a possibly a few other exceptions, the level of scholarship just didn't have the those type of intellects. Why that's so is very difficult to say. I saw somebody, I believe it was last summer, they had an article in Time magazine, or was it 2 summers ago, and someone was discussing why it is that we don't have Einsteins and Freuds like we had a century ago. And it's difficult to explain why. I mean, we don't know. It could be certain social reasons. It's hard to explain why certain periods give us certain great people, but we haven't really had a period like the period of the Rishonim, where we really had truly great scholars in Talmud. And we don't fool ourselves if we don't, you know, the level of scholarship is not there. We see it, the scholars know it, it's just not there. So we spend our time, you know, there's plenty to study, and we study the works of the great scholars, and, you know, in terms of learning Torah, there's no problem, you know. But simultaneously, we realize that we don't have those scholars that we had during the period of the Rishonim. And Abulafia lived during that period, and Rashba was one of those great scholars. But he reappears on the scene later, at a later date. And some of the later people do seem to make reference to him. But and of course, the modern day, the false Kabbalists will always say, well, oh, 1 second, but he was accepted by so-and-so. So I just want you to know for the record that he is never really mentioned by name, even by the later people who are not considered anywhere near the scholarship of a Rashba. I want to make that clear to you. And there may have been one or two who recognized him. They were not those kind of scholars, okay? But again, his words are never mentioned. For 200 years, his name is not even mentioned. There was a famous Kabbalist in, a Spanish Kabbalist, okay? And, his name was Rabbi Judah Chayat. Okay, funny. Same, it's my last name. And he wrote about Abulafia, and he was a Kabbalist, famous Kabbalist, and he says, I saw the books that a wise man, his name is Rabbi Abulafia, wrote, he says, he calls him a wise man, but then he immediately says, and due to his ignorance and his arrogance, he called himself Abraham the Teacher. So then he says, in jest, he says that when the temple was destroyed, prophecy was given to, the Talmud's prophecy was given to Shotim, to total fools. And he says, and that's exactly what he is. And he says, be careful, don't listen to anything he says, because his books are filled with imaginations, forgeries, and things that he invented from his own heart. And he says he called his book the light of the mind, and the man walks in darkness. And he says, and also, he says he wrote a guide to the guide, and he says, and he tried to, this was one of the most, I saw a false Kabbalist, the modern Kabbalist, who quoted this, and I believe David did too, where he tries to say that Maimonides was a Kabbalist. I mean, now, that's like just ridiculous. Abulafia tried to say that Maimonides worked with was truly a Kabbalist. I mean, it's just absurd. Anyone that sees that just knows that that's crazy. It's like saying Albert Einstein was a spiritualist, or saying Houdini was a great physicist. I mean, it's like ridiculous. So I just want you to be aware a little bit, to have a knowledge of the Abulafia incident, which a lot of the false Kabbalists always, you know, always make recourse to. Okay. Are there any questions?
Okay.
Don't think so.
Okay. Then I think I really basically covered the area of Kabbalah. If you'd like to have a couple more minutes, I would just take something that I did from the this.
Okay.
There are some interesting verses in this past week's reading. The one that everyone's probably familiar with, and that is that where it says you cannot sacrifice outside of the temple, and it says, but when the Torah refers to the temple, which is eventually the temple in Jerusalem, so the Torah uses strange language. Now, there are two references here. One is Deuteronomy 12:5, where it says, but only to the place that God your God will choose from all of your tribes to place his name there, you shall search for his dwelling, that's the Shekhinah, and you shall come there. And there you shall bring all your sacrifices, and it goes to, it just keeps going about that. Then, later, in verse 11, it starts off again, as if it didn't say that before. It says, and it'll be the place that God, your God, chooses, and here it says, to establish, his name there. So it says, there you should bring all your sacrifices, and again, the same thing. So, of course, the rabbis of the Talmud, having the principles of studying Torah, say, why the repetition? There's no such thing as extra verses in the Torah. And the rabbis of Talmud show that the first verse is referring to the Mishkan, which was at Shiloh. I don't know how you pronounce it, Shiloh? I don't know how to pronounce it in English. The second one is the one that's referring to the temple in Jerusalem, because there were two. There was one in Shiloh, which was established, which existed for some 380 years, approximately. And then later, after that, they went to Nov and Givon for several years, short amount of years, and then the temple was finally established in Jerusalem. But there were two main places for the temple. One was Shiloh, and that was where Eli the Kohen was, and that's where Hannah went. She went to Shiloh, if you remember. So Shiloh was really was just like Jerusalem, but not quite the same. Okay. Now not quite the same, because it had the same laws with regard to it. You could not do any sacrifices outside of Shiloh, and just like you couldn't do any sacrifices outside of Jerusalem. But the difference between Shiloh and Jerusalem was Shiloh was temporary and Jerusalem was permanent, because it says that in Psalms that King David said that that God said to him about Jerusalem, this is my resting place for eternity. Okay. Now, there's a couple of questions I think that we should ask. First of all, by the way, this is a Bible critics want to say they don't want to accept the veracity of the Torah, so they want to say the Torah was written at a later period after the two kingdoms were established, in the north and the south, and that the Deuteronomy was written by those in the south, because they keep on talking about the place that God chose, namely their own, which was in Judah, Jerusalem. Of course, if that were the case, then if they just wrote it, then they would put the word Jerusalem there. As a matter of fact, that's a good question. The question is, why does it say that God, the place that God will choose? First of all, how is he going to choose it? It does not say anywhere is how God chooses it. Did it through a prophet, any way that we know? Secondly, why didn't God simply say, when you come to Shiloh, this is going to be one, and second, when you come to Jerusalem? Why is that any different than the conquest of the land? I mean, okay, the place wasn't called Jerusalem, it was called Yavus. All right, certainly. So when you come to Yavus, so there you should establish my temple. That's what God should have said. Why does it say the place that God will choose? That's like a cryptic, vague kind of a statement. I mean, it doesn't say where it is. Why is it hidden? So I believe the answer is part of the Torah philosophy, and that is that the Torah philosophy is that the Torah does not disclose events in the future. Very careful. That's why in Daniel it says that everything is hidden and sealed till the end of times. And many of the scholars say, of course, that that's why all these predictions about Messiah have to be false, because even Daniel himself didn't know the end of time was hidden even from him. But the Torah does not disclose generally speaking, events in the future because man is supposed to function with his free will, okay? And knowing events in the future would be detrimental to his free will function. People just focus on it. That's what happens, by the way. Whenever you have these people that start these messianic type things, what happens is they just get fixated to, it's going to happen in a year. They don't perfect themselves. They don't get, they're just fixated to this, and it's just, their lives are just a total waste. But over here, what the Torah is saying is the place that God will choose. You see, holiness, It means God will choose for what purpose? He will choose that place, and he will, so to speak, rest there, okay? His Shekhinah will be there, okay? Which means that that his relationship to that place, his divine providence, will be related very closely or expressed in that place. Now, that is a very wonderful thing for man to have such a situation, and that's the whole concept of the loss of the temple, that we lost the so to speak divine presence, okay? But what the Torah is saying is a very important concept, namely that if God would have said, when you get to Jerusalem, put the temple over there, so that would mean that it would be no different than anything else, like conquering the land. You'll get there, you'll put the ark over there, make the temple there, and God will say then I will dwell there. Which would mean that the dwelling of God is simply dependent upon a physical acquisition and accomplishing a physical deed, a physical action. That is misleading, it's wrong, and it's against the whole philosophy of Torah. See, holiness, which is tied to God's presence, comes about through man's activity. This is something which Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned on several occasions. For instance, Mount Sinai, we don't know where it is. It has no holiness, nothing. Even though that was the place where the greatest manifestation of God, his revelation, took place at Sinai. Yet that's not holy at all. But somewhere in the desert, we don't care where it is. We're not really interested. But the Mount Moriah, which is in Jerusalem, that has holiness because Abraham brought his son, in compliance with God's will, he brought his son there to sacrifice him. And eventually that became the place of the temple, because that is the Torah, the Torah demands that holiness come from man. See, an act that God does alone is of course important for us, but that is not what causes holiness. What causes holiness is man's deeds. So the reason why the Torah says the place that God will choose is because what the Torah is saying is that God, in other words, everybody wants to know, well, when will God dwell among us? We want, what do we have to